Isn't today great? Today is such a great day. Everything is so great.
We're going to have a lot of fun. We got some wonderful people for you.
All you mommies and daddies out there who complain to the radio station, I got something to say to you.
And the first thing you've got to do is say the call letters properly. Okay?
It's an incredible metamorphosis of love and emotion and sensitivity and tenderness and fun and joy and happiness.
Did you know that this show represents health and hope?
Yeah, it's a great day for a lively conversation on the Amy Beth Arkley Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? Today we'll take on the role of the artist in our society, particularly in contentious times, with noted author, scholar, and poet Roberta Tejada. We'll also have our take on the cultural cacophony in measured doses, inspiration to action, challenge success stories, and you in the mix. Are you listening live? It is Friday, October 11th. We made it, huh? 12 noon out west, 2 p.m. central, 3 o'clock here in the east, number in motion, 347-857-4505. Hey, you know, Twitter's a 24-7 proposition, so live or on podcast, jump in when it works for you at AB Writes. And should you find yourself joining us for the live broadcast, you can also avail yourself of the Facebook page and the PopNet chat box. It's all being helmed by our talented, tenacious TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora in the booth, and Mella headquarters. Show's brought to you in part by Old Navy. Fall in for great styles and savings at Old Navy. Also by our friends at PopNet, Arts, Culture, Conversation, on air, online, up and running 24/7. And they do indeed feature select editions of the Amy Beth Arkley Show and those robust, dare we declare it, occasionally raucous roundtables. Let's welcome Roberta Tejada to the show. He is the noted scholar, Renaissance man of sorts. He is the U. Roy and Lily Kranz Cullen Distinguished Professor at the University of Houston. He teaches in both the Creative Writing Program and at our History Department. He is the author of a number of titles of poetry and art history. He's also a translator, an editor, an essayist, photography historian, and critic who lived in Mexico for 10 years in the late 80s to mid-late 90s. So he's got very intriguing perspective, and his latest tome is Still Nowhere in an Empty Vastness. It is a collection of essays and poetic manifestos, and we're delighted to welcome him to the show. Roberto, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Annabeth. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. Congratulations on the book, and so much to talk about in the role of the artist in general, and particularly those from marginalized populations, and certainly the Latino culture has been under siege, really, in the last few years. Starting with President Trump and his declaration during his campaign that kind of took on the Mexican culture in particular as murderers and rapists and drug dealers and still with this wall nonsense. So the culture is kind of under siege, and I kind of wonder, do people feel more or less empowered or marginalized? It's an interesting question because I think about Toni Morrison, the late great writer, and one of her famous quotes, I don't have it in front of me, but basically paraphrasing the idea that in troubled times, it's not the time for artists to despair, but it's a time for us to be more mobilized and to be more empowered and to use our words, our language. I would dare say she was talking particularly about writers, but other media, whether it's your paintbrush or your microphone, whatever your outlet and your craft may be, as somebody who's kind of, despite our contentious times, that full kind of a gal, I think there's always opportunity within the adversity. What's your take on that?
I agree 100%. As a matter of fact, when I was putting these essays together, when I was assembling the collection, it was precisely in the summer of 2016 in which the rhetoric, the anti-immigrant rhetoric, and the rhetoric of our then candidate and now President Trump was vilifying Mexicans in particular, but all kinds of peoples of color, LGBTQ communities, Muslim Americans, and so forth, that I thought was really pressing to bring this volume out because I agree with the wonderful phrase by Toni Morrison. I think instead of despairing, it is really the time to mobilize language and to mobilize images. And so really what this collection is, in a way, they're really stories and they're episodes of the very, very far past and the very close present. And so far as I go back to the 17th century and 18th century to some of the chronicles of the conquistadors and castaways in the person of Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, I compare him to the white colonial settler Mary Rowlandson. And then I, you know, sort of travel through the 19th century and into the 20th century and into the present. And I would say that today, this is why it was important for me to talk about Latino, Latinx artists who are producing here in the United States and are trying to contest and reimagine and reconfigure the otherwise sometimes negative images of Latinx peoples in the United States.
Yes, fascinating. I mean, you do take that historical, you know, broad view, but it is not necessarily completely chronological in the way that's set out.
That's right. I like traveling back and forth. I think of it as a kind of speculative history, that these stories are continuous in a sense, but the storytelling can be discontinuous. It can move back and forth in time, because I think part of the leitmotifs of the book is that the present can be informed by these stories from the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And perspectives change, and in many ways, I know you've mentioned, or somebody mentioned, that this book has been like almost 3 decades in the making, that some of the essays were written many years ago and the way you pulled them together, but they resonate so much today, probably because of our contentious times that we find ourselves in.
Yes, I mean, it's a kind of one of those unfortunate, uncanny moments, right, that I was putting these together, and you're right, some of them go back to the years in which I was living in Mexico City in the late 90s and late 80s and early 90s, and I couldn't help but feel that foreboding and that kind of uncanny when I'm putting essays together that were from 27 years ago, and yet they still resonated in what was taking place in the present.
Yeah, the more things change, the more they say the same routine, which is unfortunate in some ways. Talk about your own desire to move to Mexico, and also it's interesting that so many artists from the United States and other parts of the world gravitated to, not just Latino artists, but of different cultures, gravitated toward Mexico. What was your attraction to go there, and what do you think the appeal of that country is for so many artists?
Well, that was so I often say that it was by accident, although what happened was I had completed my undergraduate degree, and I hadn't had plans to continue any kind of graduate study, and a mentor of mine, who is the translator of the Nobel laureate Octavio Paz, suggested I move to Mexico and put me in contact with Don Octavio, and it was by chance that Octavio asked me to start working for his journal, Vuelta, which I worked for 2 or 3 years, and then I became his personal assistant while at the same time working for another journal, an art journal. So that's kind of the beginning of my interest in both the literary arts and the visual arts. Now, the appeal was, on a personal level, my parents, who have now passed, but they're Colombian-American. I grew up in Los Angeles, and really the city of Los Angeles in the 60s and 70s the Latinos that lived in Los Angeles were primarily Mexican. So my parents often, just to simplify matters for U.S. Americans who didn't know the difference between Colombia and Mexico, would often just say that they were Mexican as a sort of economic way of interacting. And they took me to Mexico City when I was in my youth, and it was a city that I long wanted to return to. And most of my most of the friends of my family were either Mexican American or Latinx of some sort. So, having read about Mexico City prior to going there, it was clear to me that it had always been a kind of magnet for artists and writers. And indeed, when I arrived there, I was asked by Octavio Paz to put together an anthology of U.S. American poets who had either written about Mexico, who had lived in Mexico, and that turned into the first version of what I later revised and amplified into one of the essays there about precisely this history of U.S. American writers and artists who have spent time in Mexico, particularly in the years right after the Mexican Revolution, which took place from 1910 to 1920, and many U.S. American artists were gravitated there because of this kind of cultural vibrancy that took place in the years posterior to the Revolution, when you have muralists like Diego Rivera, José Clemente Orozco, David Alfaro Siqueiros, and painters like Frida Kahlo and others that might be familiar to your listeners, that really created a kind of effervescence that was very appealing to U.S. artists, in part because of this idea that they wanted to see an alternative to the over-mechanized and over-industrial lifestyles of the United States.
So there you go. It's the role of the artist, again, looking for the backlash or the consequences or the aftermath of something like a revolution to come out and see what's next.
Yes, I mean, I think
exactly.
I mean, I think many of these artists were. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, you go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say that many of these artists exactly were attracted to the idea of social movements and the idea that the artist has a role in, especially in social projects like the Mexican Revolution, where culture, art, the visual arts, literature were primary in what was seen as the kind of the social engineering of what a community and what a culture could look like. And this was very appealing to U.S. American artists.
Fascinating. And of course, and then they would bring back, if they returned, and when they returned, a different perspective. And so that's how there's so much cross-pollination in terms of culture, right?
That's correct. And not only that, I also follow the storylines in which Mexican artists traveled to the United States. I'm thinking precisely of the three muralists that I just mentioned, Diego Rivera, Siqueiros, and Orozco, who were commissioned to produce very important murals in the United States. I'm thinking of the New School for Orozco in New York City. There was a Siqueiros in Los Angeles and Diego Rivera in Detroit, for example.
The idea of opening it up, and when you see these things, again, when we're talking about the cross-pollination of culture and how the arts can open everybody up to it. And that's why I think even in contentious times and when people are polarized and in our own little echo chambers, and you know, artists are dangerous folks because we commune with everybody. And that's, I think, the important thing to keep in mind.
They are. I hope also that artists can be seen as translators or ambassadors. That is, that I think some of this misunderstanding of the present, if we look to our artists, if we look to artists in the past and in the present, we can see how they were really trying to understand how to make someone else legible, right? How do we make another culture legible? How do I make another person legible? Well, I think that this is the mandate of the artist, and I believe that that's what Toni Morrison meant in her phrase about the optimism.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's bridging the gap, and the whole ambassadorship, I like that idea, the idea that you're... it's more about celebrating differences and the commonality that we all have, the common threads, both of those things at the same time. I think you can do that through the art.
Yes, acknowledging
them.
In
a way that's harder to
right?
do. Yeah, acknowledging them, exactly.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about your title of your book, The Still Nowhere and the Empty Vastness. It comes from another essay from another poet, correct, William Bronk?
That's right. William Bronk is a poet and essayist who, in a book of essays that he gathered together in the 1980s, called Vectors and Smoothable Curves. What he did was put together essays similar, I feel very aligned to that book, because he was also thinking in an hemispheric model. He, being from New York, from Hudson in New York, traveled to Mexico and to Peru and to Mesoamerican sites. I'm thinking specifically of Palenque, and he wrote this very beautiful meditation on the ruins in Palenque called The Occupation of Space. And it's there that he really feels or is awakened, becomes aware and conscious of his identity as a U.S. American citizen, but also this understanding that all civilizations, if we think about the long view of history, are transient and impermanent, and that one, you know, civilizations either evanesce through violence or through other factors or through conquest and colonization. And at one point he talks about feeling was like being still nowhere in an empty vastness, that feeling of impermanence. And so it seemed to me that I draw from that, and I cite William Bronk in one of the essays, and it seemed to me a very compelling way of thinking about the long view of history.
It's not just the artist, and it's not just in terms of Latino culture, but it's all history, right?
That's right. That's right. And I think that particularly it's interesting that this cross-pollinization that you speak of, I think that's the right word. So Bronk, curiously, has been translated into Spanish because in Mexico these meditations ring true of a kind of interest in the way that one culture views another culture. The Italian novelist Italo Calvino once called what I'm referring to a negative mirror. That is, it's not quite a perfect reflection of one culture, that travelers from one culture to another will always inevitably project their own fears and desires, but that nevertheless tells us something interesting about the origin culture, or the culture of the traveler, and that putting these together tells us something about what it means to live together.
Fascinating stuff. Now, you're also a teacher now, and talk a little bit about, as we come full circle, on the concept of whether we should be optimistic or pessimistic. What are the students that you work with on a regular basis, or what are they saying? What is their feeling? Do they feel despair, or do they feel empowered? Or both?
I think that it's a combination of both. I'm very lucky to teach the kind of students I teach at the University of Houston. I believe that the university is really an engine of opportunity for many of, if not most of our undergraduates are first-time university, first-time college-bound students. There are 27 languages that are spoken on our campus. We are one of the most diverse campuses in the nation in terms of ethnic and racial diversity. I think that because of that diversity and that the daily encounters and negotiations that students do among themselves, I think they see that encounter conversation, that the university as a place of knowledge, but also of conversations, allows for a kind of optimism that, and as you might imagine, that many of my students who are also Latino or Hispanic, we're a Hispanic-designated institution, have concerns also about the ways in which this anti-immigrant rhetoric has been escalated. But I think that precisely in the kinds of things that we teach, this is why to me the humanities, be it art history or through creative writing, really give us entry points into this idea of how to make someone else legible, right? That making and knowing, it breaks the boundaries between self and other, and that this is ultimately the task of the artist. And for those of us who are eternal students of the arts.
Yeah. The ambassadorship, the cross-pollination and the conversation, as you say, I think is so important to break down those barriers and keep those conversations going. And certainly as a professor and as a scholar and author yourself, you're doing all of that. The book is Still Nowhere in an Empty Vastness. Can people find out? Do you have a website where people can go to get details about you or no?
Yes, I would recommend two websites. The website of my publisher, very excellent independent publisher, Noemi Press, and that website is Noemi Press, NOEMIPRESS.org. I have a website which is Roberto Tejada, no space, .com, and that's RoberToTejada.com. And I can always be looked, I can always be found at the University of Houston's English Department and Art History Department.
Terrific. We will update when we send out the link to the podcast. We'll put out the links to those websites as well. Speaking with you, Roberto Tejada, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. That's Roberto Tejada. Again, we will post the podcast when it becomes available later today, and along with that, I will post those websites where you can find out more information about both the book, Still Nowhere in the Empty Vastness, and all his other endeavors as well. Pleasure talking with him. And with you. Stick around, it is the Amy Beth Arkwi Show. We're coming right back. Welcome back to the Amy Beth Arkwi Show. On your mind, Twitter is AB Wright. Phone line 347-857-4505. Should you find yourself listening live on Friday, October 11th, we have the Facebook page and the PopNet chat box open as well. Again, thanks going out to Roberto Tejada, the author, the scholar, the poet, and the new book is Still Nowhere in an Empty Vastness, talking about the role of the artist as an ambassador. I really love that idea and how we can break through barriers, and break through prejudices, and there's always optimism at the end. There's a silver lining for this contentious cloud that we find ourselves living under. I know it's tough, indeed, but we do. And the arts are important, and getting in touch with your own creativity, I think, is so important. I want to talk a little bit about our Inspiration to Action Challenge. Today it's Jerry in Laconia, New Hampshire, who writes in, I am delving headfirst into a memoir. Thanks for helping me and appreciate what needs to be appreciated and all the work that comes with it. That's a little esoteric, Jerry, but I think I know what you're talking about. And please keep working on it and let us know how you're doing with it, because it's always important to keep in touch if you can. Hey, the Inspiration to Action Challenge, has it worked for you? Because if it has, I'd love to give you a shout-out. You deserve it. You're also spurring other folks on to their creative endeavors. On the other hand, if you need a little creative kick in the keister, that's what we always say. Let's start a creativity coaching counseling conversation. The first one's on me. I'll give you a primer on the challenge, some other tips and tricks to get you in a more creative mode. Do it all via the website. It's AmyBethArkawy, ArkAwy.com. Easy access via the Twitter feed, and we'll be in touch within a week or two. If you're looking for a consult. And while you're at the website, you can peruse my stories, the Eliza Gordon mystery, some other goodies up for grabs. Also, you can chime in with your guest suggestions, your big story and forgotten 45 requests, kind of one-stop shopping, no groceries, no shoes, but pretty much anything else that you need at the website, amybetharkaway.com. Creativity, it'll keep us moving, makes you feel better too, and I think it bridges the gap as we're all ambassadors to something bigger and better. Keep doing what you need to do.
Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. Cause there's a million things to be, you know that there are. And if you want to live high, live high. And if you want to live low, live low. Cause there's a million ways to go, you know that there are. What you want, the opportunity's on, and if you find a new way, you can do it today, you can make it all true, and you can make it undo, you see, ah, it's easy, ah, you only need to know. Well, if you want to say yes, say yes. And if you want to say no. But there's a million ways to go, you know that there are. And if you want to be me. And if you want to be you. But there's a million things to do, you know that there are. You can do what you want, the opportunity's on, and if you find a new way, you can do it today, you can make it all true, and you can make it undo, you see, ah, it's easy, ah, you only know. Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free. Cause there's a million things to be. You know that there are, 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 you know that there are.
Talks about some fateful day, but I guess that this was mine. I may be here to tell some kind of story, but I think it's gonna take a little time. That's alright. See, I'm rocking in a cradle out of hall somewhere, and I am lost inside. Maybe I am falling, maybe I am flying, but I know if I am crying, she's holding. that bottle filled with lightning and rain. She keeps calling out for someone, but she's riding on a train. Riding on the ghost train. Well, she keeps on riding. She's gonna keep on riding. Mama, keep on riding.
Ghost Train on the Amy Beth Arquis Show and our unofficial theme song for the Inspiration to Action Challenge, Cat Stevens, Sing Out. Lots of ways to be, lots of arts to pursue. Pick one or more that works for you. Oh, I'm a poet. I don't even know it. The arts can soothe you. Yesterday was National World Mental Health Day, and I always say people, those of us who are in the helping professions and the arts, sometimes don't take care of ourselves. We take care of other people. You got to take care of yourself, too, so keep thinking about that. But certainly, caressing your inner artist and pursuing what spurs you into happiness and your desires, that helps. So delve into the creativity that's within you, within all of us. It just manifests itself in different ways and different degrees from person to person. I really do believe that. And if we can help you out here, you know that I'm open to that at all times. So stick around for that. And music soothes your soul too, right? One of the before we get to it, we'll go around the social media horn in a moment, but last week we started to pursue delve into Sheryl Crow's latest album, Threads. She claims it's her last album. I don't know if I believe that. She's not in her last music. She says she's going to just do one-offs, as most people do now with the way the internet works. But this album is so beautifully constructed because it's these collaborations with other great artists. And there's something about putting an album together. And I'm of a certain age where I remember when albums were albums, the old vinyl stuff, and you get them and you can wait to pursue the liner notes and everything else. Nowadays it's done differently. I understand that, but sometimes having that collection together really does make sense. And it's curated in such a way. But here's some good stuff, and there's one. I think this is going to make you feel good. It's Sheryl Crow with, get this, Legends, Mavis Staples, and Bonnie Raitt. It's called Live Wire from the collection Threads. I mean, the Dark Wish. Give a list.
As a weed, but he met his match on the day he met me.
putting me right back to your door. No telling when the lightning strikes, the way you make me feel, I gotta hold on tight.
I got a now.
Here come the weekend.
That's Dave Edmonds on the Amy Beth Berkley Show for Claire. Thanks for chiming in. I appreciate the kind words via Twitter. And a great one from three great ladies of contemporary music, Sheryl Crow, Mavis Staples, and Bonnie Raitt. Live Wire from Sheryl Crow's latest and perhaps final collection. We'll see about that, called Threads. Intriguing, good stuff indeed. It is the Amy Beth Berkley Show. Happy to have you aboard. Twitter is AB Wright's, phone line 347-857-4505. Should you find yourself listening live on our Friday, October 11th show. We also have the Facebook page and the PopNet chat box open for those joining us for the live broadcast. PopNet chat box, Darby chiming in. Very intriguing conversation, AB. Thank you so much. And you're right, artists do have a place in the world, but so do politicians, and their job right now is to kick you-know-who's ass out of office. I know what you're talking about. Peter on Twitter says, I have no interest in season three of the Trump show. The Trump impeachment story is a... aside from the general interest to see the show get canceled, but it's too bad that this spectacle has given status quo royalty Biden great press. It makes the public feel like he is the one who should be the next president. I don't know. Maybe, Peter, maybe not. He's getting a lot of attention, and maybe he is strong enough to take on Trump. He's been playing the most electable argument, and Trump, of course, and his cohorts, Rudy Giuliani and company, and boy, the spectacle and the shenanigans going on there is crazy. Remember projection deflection when Trump talks about corruption and crooked behavior. Look at his own litany of misdeeds, right? I mean, it's just crazy. But who knows? I mean, is Biden going to be tainted too much? That's the question. Does he have his own baggage that he's toting around? Personally, I would be happy if it was Joe Biden, just because I think he is a decent person. He can take the moral high ground and maybe bring the country together. Are we ready for more bolder, younger leadership? That's a possibility, although the top three right now are in their 70s. Elizabeth Warren is 70. She's the youngest of the bunch. Then you have Biden at 75, 76, and Bernie Sanders, who probably won't make it to the finish line at 78. But who knows? I always say, you know, it's too early in the game, and if you look at the past, and of course we live in very unprecedented times, so who the heck knows, but in past primaries, the first person who's the front runner doesn't always wind up being the winner, and likely is not. I mean, look at, you know, Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton story in 2007, 2008. Howard Dean versus John Edwards, and then John Kerry in 2004. I mean, the people that emerged were not the people that were the front runner going into Iowa, so we'll just have to see what happens. I'm still waiting to see some of those mid-benchers, like Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris. I think they have a shot at projecting ahead. So far, neither one has gotten a tremendous amount of traction. Buttigieg has got a lot of money, though, in his coffers, so he'll be able to have some give some legs to the race, so to speak. And it's very fascinating. I was thinking about Buttigieg the other day and talking about him. And what would be the downside? Because what could you do in terms of the mudslinging to go after Buttigieg? Because he's gay? Well, he's out in the open, and who the heck cares, because the people that won't vote for him because he's gay wouldn't be voting for him anyway, I think. Because he's young? Yeah, maybe. But the thing is, he's about half the age of Donald Trump, and he's about twice as mature. So age, you know, if you don't want to be ageist on the upper end, where you say don't be ageist, Bernie's still spry and all that, then don't be ageist on the younger end either. Because here's a guy who is a combat veteran, carries himself with distinction and maturity, and has a moral compass for sure. So I think it'll be fascinating to see him go head-to-head with Donald Trump. I also think it'll be fascinating to see Kamala Harris take on Donald Trump in a debate. So I wouldn't rule those two out, and anybody else, by the way, Booker. Klobuchar. There are other people in that middle lane who could occupy the middle lane that Biden has. The question about Elizabeth Warren, who has shown herself to have campaign prowess like nobody's business over the summer, and that has to count for something. She's still going to be attacked with the quote-unquote socialist label, although she's going to try to talk her way out of it. She's got a plan for that, but she also you know, it might sound like too much pie in the sky for some people to take it. Is she electable enough? We don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But is it too risky to take that chance when we really have to ouster Donald Trump? That becomes the question we all have to answer. One thing I will say, I'm blue no matter who. Whoever gets the nomination, I'm in. I'm all in. And we have to push for that big turnout election because that's what we were going to really need. So we got to hold steady to that thought. And even if you are more of a Republican-leaning voter, you got to think about saving what's left of our democracy because another 4 years of this guy, I think we're in big trouble. We're in trouble already, but we can be in bigger trouble. That's my take. I'd love to hear yours, of course. Twitter is AB Wright's phone line 347-857-4505. Anybody else coming through that needs to talk about it? Let's see. Who else do we have here, Trudy? Anybody good coming up? No comments. Really just Trump impeachment, Trump impeachment, more Trump impeachment, and a picture of the GOP devolution. From Lincoln to Nixon to Trump, that cartoon that was going around, I think, last year. A lot of fun there. Impeachment now, make America America again, says Colleen and Dawn, both weaving in those popular memes. So it's important. And Jenny says, Rudy and Trump, they can be cellmates together. That sounds like a fantasy. There was a thing years and years ago, I remember as a kid, an album called Dick Nixon, A Fantasy, in which they had this, it was David Fry, I believe was the comedian's name, and it was all these little sketches about Dick Nixon in jail. That never happened, but a lot of the people surrounding him went to jail, and those people in the White House, aides, former aides, they should all think about that when they're ignoring the subpoenas, if you know what I'm saying. Interesting to see what happened. The former Ukrainian ambassador to the Ukraine was, or is still, I guess, being deposed. I'm not sure why these things are behind closed doors. Somebody brought that up the other day, that all this stuff should be done in a public hearing. But I guess they're depositions, so they have to be behind closed doors. I'm not really sure why. But it does make some people feel like maybe the Democrats are hiding things, too. So I think everything should be out in the open. Let's have public hearings like we have with the DNI guy, McGuire, like they have with Corey Lewandowski. It's fascinating to watch. Not everybody will watch it. Watch part of it, but at least you'll see it out there as opposed to getting these transcripts or these dribs and drabs about what's going on. But basically what she pretty much said was that she was pushed out and that Giuliani was having some sort of a shadow agenda going on. So again, this whole projection, deflection thing, crooked, corruption, these people are making so much money, it's not even funny. And to put a taint on the Biden family, and by the way, as I said, maybe you should investigate Hunter Biden. They already did that supposedly and it's been debunked, but that's a separate issue. It doesn't mean that Trump was right in what he was doing in terms of asking for something for his own political gain. That is verboten, and it should be, and everybody, not just Mitt Romney, should come out and say it on the Republican side. It's wrong, and by the way, it should be impeachable, and all the subscriptions should be impeachable. And the stuff in the Mueller report was impeachable, but it wasn't exciting enough because Mueller laid an egg and was boring when he testified. It's beyond me. I don't get it. I just don't. What's your take? Twitter, AB Wright, phone line 347-857-4505, Facebook page, pop in the chat box, open too, as we celebrate the seasons, and we're finally kind of in the feel of autumn in my neck of the woods. I know folks in the Dakotas and Montana experience winter already with lots of snow. They're having wildfires out in California. It's a dreary day out here, but at least it's cool and a little damp, and it doesn't feel like a golden autumn day, but we can think about that and fantasize with Van Morrison on Amy the Darkly Show. Here's a beauty.
Well, I heard the bells ringing. I was thinking about winter down this godforsaken place. When my confidence was well, then I tripped and I fell right flat on my face. Now I'm standing in the wreck, and I feel like coming back, and the sun is shining gold. Put a smile on my face, get back in the human race, and get on with the show. And I'm taking in the Indian summer, and I'm soaking it up in my mind, and I'm pretending that it's paradise for the golden autumn day. 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 I was weeping and lost. I was parking my car in this dimly lit town. I was attacked by two thugs who took me for most and shoved me down on the ground. Then they pulled out a knife and I fought my way out as they scuffed from the scene. Well, this is no New York street and there's no Bobby on the beat and things ain't just what they seem. Summer. And I'm soaking it up in my mind. And I'm pretending that it's paradise for the golden on day. For the golden on day. For the golden on day. For the golden on day.
Golden on. cold-hearted, seems made for just a boy and girl. I never dreamed it you, any fall could come in view.
Fitzgerald in Early Autumn and the great Van Morrison, Golden Autumn Day. It is Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Thanks so much for spending time with us today. Thank you, Roberta Tejada, the scholar, the poet, the author of Still Nowhere in an Empty Vastness. Find out more at robertatejada.com. We'll post the link along with the link to the website along with a link to our podcast when it becomes available later today. Don't forget, all the shows are archived as such. You can follow the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show wherever you get your podcasts from, BTR to Mixcloud, Stitcher to iTunes, NetNow, Spotify. All roads lead, of course, back to our website, amybetharkowy.com, and select editions, too, in the Arts Radio Network and PopNet. So there you have it. And don't forget to connect with us via social media. You can friend me on Facebook, follow our producer, Trudy Hart, on Twitter at Radio Trudy, and follow me on Twitter at AB Writes. Some passings to note, the legendary comedian and showbiz stalwart, Rip Taylor, left us in a wave of confetti at the age of 84, and the iconic rock and roll drummer, from groups like Cream and Blind Faith and the Ginger Baker Project. Ginger Baker passed away at the age of 80. Left us some great music, though. We'll leave you with one from Blind Faith, Ginger Baker and his compadres, Can't Find My Way Home. Please drive safe, play nice, dream big, and come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Take care and love you all.